On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we open up the indictment. Get cozy with the Eastern District of New York and the investigation into Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz's gambling malfeasance. Got some news on that front this week. We'll dig through it, let you know the pertinent, the odd, the goofy, and all of the above. We will chat about the rookies of the year, which were announced on Monday. And we will preview the remainder of the awards due to be unveiled later this week. Baseball Barbacast, let her rip. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that loves Prop Joe more than prop bets. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And do you think Prop Joe and Avon Barksdale were gambling on that basketball game in The Wire? You got to think so.
Here's what I know. You could never cap Prop Joe at $200. I feel pretty good about saying that. Good morning, Jake Mintz. It is so good to see you. It is nice to be here on this Tuesday, November 11th, recording a baseball podcast with you, my friend. This is going to be a wide-ranging episode of Baseball Barbacast, but we must begin, of course, with some pretty big news. Our opener is an update involving Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz.
Anytime you hear the words Eastern District of New York, you know that it's not going to be a normal baseball story. And that was the case a few days ago when news came down that Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz, two pitchers, technically still of the Cleveland Guardians, were indicted for conspiring with bettors to rig pitches in order to make money from gambling websites. We first caught wind of the story during the season when first Ortiz and then Clase were put on, you'll know the exact wording, Jordan, the ineligible list. What is the
restricted list tone? Restricted administrative list, leave.
Yep. Whatever. It was on they were put in timeout. They were told to sit in the corner and wait for investigations to conclude. And while this is not MLB's official investigation, that, as far as we know, is still ongoing, this seems pretty definitive, as the Eastern District of New York is not one to fling conjecture and rumor around. And so we got a variety of details, some disturbing, some funny, relating to Andy Pages, but all of them undeniably compelling.
Yeah, and, you know, this story has just kind of been hanging out, looming over Major League Baseball for the last 4 months, but it was kind of in the background, and as they continue to extend each pitcher's leave indefinitely, we didn't really know when we were going to get any sort of resolution. And in some respects, we are still a long way from getting a resolution. What we do have now is some details, a timeline, and a more clear picture of what was going on. And in some respects, it's kind of exactly what we all assumed based on the initial round of reporting and the initial, like, oh, this pitch looks suspicious. Oh, is this him throwing a ball on purpose for the purposes of making money? And in a very, very simple phrase, the answer is yes. The answer is absolutely yes. And I think that the few main takeaways involved with this indictment, and by the way, I mean, we're going to reference a few excerpts along the way. It's a 23-page document. Really, it's like 17, 16 pages that I encourage everyone to go read because, one, it's incredibly compelling. There are details in here that are exactly, I mean, we're talking timestamps of texts and phone calls, and some of that stuff is what's really the most shocking. But also, tells a story that, you know, we mentioned that Ortiz was the first one to be placed on the restricted list. And it does seem that Ortiz's two crooked pitches were the ones that really caught, you know, the suspicion of the gambling integrity firms. I think that's basically been confirmed. Yeah. That's what would flag this. The biggest takeaway from this indictment is that Class A was the one leading the charge here. That Class A was doing this as long ago as 2023 is a pretty shocking revelation. And that Ortiz, while he is the one that has already been arrested, because as we know at this stage, Class A is not in the country, that Ortiz was kind of joined later on and now finds himself in similarly deep trouble. But Class A is the real takeaway here in some very, very troubling ways.
Because I think when the news first dropped over the summer and Ortiz went down first, there was maybe an assumption that Ortiz was, you know, in charge or at least on equal guilt footing to Class A. I think another fair assumption for that is just like Class A had more money, right? And Ortiz maybe was in more need of millions or hundreds of thousands. That is definitively not the case based upon this report. Class A is the one that is guilty.
The premise of the how much money were they making? Because I think this is another thing that as the details start coming out and as the Jeff Passons of the world are kind of posting excerpts, and this is why I encourage everyone to read the whole thing. What is still unclear is exactly how much both pitchers took back, but they summarize it as a total of over $450,000 in winnings. And they describe, in the indictment, they describe a few instances of money being directly transferred to each of the pitchers, requesting certain amounts for each of the pitchers. But whether they were doing it for $5,000 or $50,000 or $150,000 or $300,000, whatever, none of that really matters that much. Yes, it makes it easier to post
a tweet. I disagree a little.
Okay, well, let me just say, yes, it makes it easier to post a tweet that's like, he threw it all away for $5,000. And like, yeah, that's true. But especially in the case of Emmanuel Clase, when we're talking about what kind of career that he was, you could still say it just as strongly. He threw it all away for $300,000. It's evidently not about how much money they were making. Obviously, that had to be some level of motivation. Motivating factor because they thought they were getting fast cash easy. And in Class A's case, as we know, was getting away with it for some amount of time until he ended up looping Ortiz into this and then ended up getting flagged. But that's the thing. The specific amounts, I guess, is important maybe when we are talking about an Ortiz who is making major league minimum and hasn't made as much as Class A has in his career. And logically, if you're telling the story of why someone would fall into this and think, not that it's a good idea, but would be unable to resist the temptation of trying something like this, maybe that matters. But I also think in Clase's case, like there's clearly, and there's still some unanswered questions of just like how he got involved in this with this better to begin with in 2023, who that individual is, we still don't know. Seems like the government knows exactly who that is, but that's the part that we are still trying to figure out. Yeah. But the actual amounts, I think it's important. The indictment says in total over $400,000 on just 10 pitches, I think, total described.
Can I just say why I think that number is important?
Sure.
Because it's big. I mean, it's not billions or even millions, but it's big. And I think it's big enough to be flagged by the government, one. And two, I think it is a direct repudiation of MLB's constant claim that when there are big amounts being wagered on prop bets, that is flagged. The narrative that we have generally received from the league, from Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, is that the system works or has worked, right? That when there is something abnormal being wagered upon, that gets flagged. And that has also been the case right in the NBA to a certain extent, where it's like if you're throwing thousands of dollars down on the Jonte Porter under, like that's going to get caught. Now, the reason that that number is significant, the 450, is that a lot of that happened without them being caught, without Class A being caught. It was a full year. Now, it seems like he tailed off this activity in 2024.
Our knowledge, they don't describe any activity in 2024.
But I just think that that is important because if there's a scenario, I mean, we don't know, right? But it seems like there's a scenario where if he doesn't get Ortiz involved, we don't know about this and it doesn't get caught. And I think that that is a bad look for the league. And I guess now is a good time to bring up that in the wake of this news, already the league has capped, along with its betting partners, the league put out a statement on Monday, effectively announcing that it planned to cap prop bets at $200 per bet.
And remove them from parlays, which is a significant part in terms of how these winnings get multiplied. And you're wondering, how is a ball four or how is a ball one bet worth that much? Well, if you combine it with other stuff and you're guaranteed to win things, then yeah, that can get up to a lot of money pretty quickly.
Let's just talk about this news very quickly. I'm just going to laugh briefly at the word proactively, which is in the first sentence. Come on. Now, proactively, if you want to do this statement like in 2 weeks and put proactively in there, we could talk about it. But you can't do proactively the day after this. That's a big no-no. That's just not going to fly for me.
It's reactive.
It's literally reactive.
I don't know what you mean by in 2 weeks. I mean, why? Because the optics wouldn't look as silly.
Well, the optics would look a little less silly. Yes. Whatever. Now, I will say, is Pandora's box open as it pertains to gambling? Undeniably so, right? Like, we're never putting this back in. It's out. Still, this is a good thing on its own. I think we have to be able to evaluate both of those things at the same time. The gambling sports stuff is just, it's a runaway train. This is taking the runaway train from 100 miles an hour to like 75, right? it is a positive development. It is not going to stop everything, but it is certainly going to curtail what has been the most problematic aspect of sports gambling right now.
Yes. Now let's get back to what we learned in the indictment, because the other reality about this conversation is we could take this in a lot of different directions. We could go, and I think this is also what was interesting in all the different things that were already written about this in the last 48 hours. And, you know, I obviously did a brief reaction, but you could take this in a lot of other ways. Like Will Leach wrote a really good thing, basically talking about watching this and as it relates to the Luis Ortiz pitch, the second of which was against the Cardinals. And by the way, it's so weird for me because I was at, I think, over half of these games. It's just like very strange. I'm like, oh,
why
yeah,
didn't
I
you
remember
notice
that.
It?
Like, yeah, I know. Shame on me. It was a bad,
you
bad watchdog. Yeah. How did I not notice Better One sitting in the stands? More on that in a second.
Better One anyway, was right there.
He was right there hanging out. I was in line behind him to, you know, get a hot dog. What Willie Trude about is like, and this is the real, why does any of this matter?
Sure.
Why does Rule 21, what is the integrity of the sport? And what Will wrote about is like watching a game and thinking, oh, good, you know, Cardinals are scoring a bunch of runs against Luis Ortiz. This is awesome, right? But like even that one kernel of knowing that the first pitch was a ball on purpose to make $7,000, everything kind of starts to crumble of like, what am I watching? This is not a true competition. And it's easy to, you know, and obviously if you're thinking about how anyone in these pitchers' position would think that this is okay, they're like, what's the big deal? I throw ball one all the time when I'm not, you know, making $7,000 on it. I can get away with this. Again, this is a horribly irresponsible way to look at it. But if you're thinking about it, like that's the problem, is that they're not thinking, I'm not fixing the game. I'm throwing ball one. I throw ball one all the time. What's the big deal? But as soon as you start to threaten anything along these lines, then yes, you are. It is the fastest slippery slope to none of this is real. And that is a huge deal. That is just that's the whole thing. So that in and of itself is of course, a big challenging thing to grapple with and why this is obviously important on top of all the actual illicit illegal activity and what is driving these things behind it is the premise of the sport being, you know, honest. So let's make sure that's clear.
Class A, dude, like, you're freaking awesome. Just bet on strike one.
Well, okay. I just wanted to make sure I say that, because there's that. There's just like all the how this fits into every other gambling scandal going on in sports today. But let's try and keep it focused on the details that we learn in this indictment, because again, as we said, like that's what we can work with, and that's what we feel most comfortable kind of, you know, yapping about on a podcast. And yeah, getting back to Class A being the main driving force, again, the fact that this starts in 2023, the fact that it's as explicit as it can get, and what is the most shocking part of the whole indictment is just the blatant, you might assume, oh, okay, he's throwing these pitches and there's like some shady connection and he's got some, you know, sneaky backroom dealings to communicate with the people that are making the money and all these things. And, oh, well, maybe he's getting blackmailed to do that. Like all this. It's like, no. This dude was just hanging out with this guy. Or I guess we don't know if it's a male or female, whatever. The better one that they describe was in regular communication with Class A, not just before and after games, during games. Literally during games, Class A is texting and calling this individual and saying, we good? Yeah, we good. Great. I'm going to go out and throw ball one. You're going to make 10 grand real quick. Come on over after the fact and we'll celebrate our winnings. Like getting him tickets. I just can't even. That's the part that is so impossible. And when you think about the level of recklessness and stupidity and naivete and just like disregard for the not just the law, the rule, your teammates, like everything. That is what paints Class A as such a terrible character in this
dodo.
Whole story. And
a dodo.
Yeah, it's brutal. Like, it's brutal.
And this is the thing, right? Is when you weigh the risks and the rewards of this type of behavior, it does not compute. It does not make sense. Particularly when you are a closer on a Hall of Fame path, a year and a half, I guess, at the end when he gets shelved, a year and a half from free agency, right? Like, gonna make bank.
Well, he had the $10 million team options, which you assume would be picked up. But the point is, had more money coming to him. He was making $5 million this year and so on and so on.
Whatever. Like, it does not make sense. It just does not make sense. It's not like, you know, I'm gonna steal fruit from the bodega because I can't afford it, right? It just doesn't compute. But here's the thing. Stupid people, selfish people, greedy people are going to always play the sport. They're going to play every sport. They're going to be in all walks of life. And so there need to be guardrails set up so that those dumb, stupid, selfish people don't, you know, compromise the integrity of various institutions. Right, that is why society has laws and rules. And what we have here is, I think, the rules of the sport maybe trailing a little bit behind the gambling culture and the behavior. Because, right, like we could sit here and be like, "How could Class A do this?" It's like because this was dumb, right? Like dumb people do dumb stuff. Now, I want to leave the door open just a crack here. We don't know the origin of the relationship between Class A and the better, and better one.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a potential for MLB's investigation, the fact that that is still ongoing. I think that pertains to their relationship. That, again, this is just total conjecture and guessing. Like, there is a scenario here in which, in the beginning, Class A was coerced or is somehow financially or otherwise dependent on better one. And over the years, this became more of a collaboration, but it didn't start that way. Like, and Class A is not a victim, but he's not big villain. I just want to leave the door open a crack to that.
Sure.
So that if that is the case, I don't look like a total dodo and whatever. But
yeah.
It doesn't smell like that based upon what's in the indictment.
Yeah, especially because when they have examples of the communication between Class A and the better, and the fact that they're, you know, how they're communicating. And then what is most troubling is we bring Ortiz back into this, because again, essentially the indictment describes three instances in 23, nothing in 24, and then starting again in April 25, I think another five or six instances of Class A until June, when they describe Ortiz getting involved. But what is very important in terms of Ortiz getting involved and Ortiz deciding, yeah, I'll do this for $7,000. And then Clase is like, great, I'll essentially arrange it. Clase is the one arranging with the bet. Like, he is, and also what is even more damning for Clase, as is described in the indictment, is the alleged, basically Clase being like, oh, well, I'm getting in on this too. You know, I'm going to make $7,000 off of Ortiz's pitches also. This isn't Ortiz being like, hey, set me up with this guy and I'll make some money on the side too. Like, Clase's still also attached to that one. And that's the part where, like, again, Ortiz is if what is described in the indictment is exactly how it occurred, he is responsible. I expect him to be banned from Major League Baseball for life. That is all fine. But the truth is, as you read this, you have different human emotions about the situation. And this is the stuff that just makes me really sad, truly. And again, it's not to excuse Ortiz or say that he's necessarily a victim. But when you consider the dynamic at play, right? Luis Ortiz wasn't even Clase A's teammate. Maybe he knew him 2 years ago, whatever. But he wasn't even Clase A's teammate until this year, right? And you can imagine that when Luis Ortiz gets traded to the Guardians, who's the pitcher that he's going to go hang out with first and foremost? It's going to be Clase. Of course, that's natural. He's the other Dominican pitcher on the team. Yes, they have Jose Ramirez, which, my God, I mean, can you imagine the level of disregard and disrespect and selfishness that you have to play for the Cleveland Guardians and do something like this with Jose Ramirez as your guy? I mean, that just, honestly, like,
as your teammate and countryman.
Right, exactly. Just like unbelievable level of just not caring. But anyway, but the Ortiz part of it is it really makes me sad. And again, you can't feel too bad for him because it is someone that made a real mistake and made a choice. But that's the part of this and what I read from. And maybe there are a lot of people that will read this and not feel bad for him at all. And I totally get that. But when you just think about the dynamic and the fact that he's not someone that has made any money in his career relatively, and someone that, like, if you know about Luis Ortiz's background, who signed late, didn't have a lot of money, and has a family that he's really close with the DR, like, we know that it's also a real dynamic that players, especially from DR, and like, they're trying to send money back home all the time. That is a very, very common thing.
Not just
you could imagine. Right. And obviously, as we see, there's details in here where they're sending money back, and that becomes problematic too, because the money is illegal, or the money that they have acquired is not legal.
That's where you go into wire fraud.
That is, yeah, exactly. But those are real dynamics that, like, again, you think about this as how does this happen as a human? And it's just because as everything is described, there's no reason to think Ortiz would fall into something like this if Clase didn't exist. That's how I read this, right? Sure. And that's what's really
I agree with that. And if I was like baseball czar, legal czar, I'd be like, Clase, you're not throwing a pitch in any organized baseball that will pay you ever again. And you're going to prison for
the legal
insignificant
stuff,
amount of time.
I know that's the headline. Different.
But I'm saying, like, for Ortiz, the headline is, what, like 65 years? Like, that's not happening.
Yeah, and we know that's
just
not happening.
But my point is, like, Ortiz, significant prison time for Ortiz feels, like, probably unfair. And, like, if I after a period of time, I would let him pitch in the Dominican Republic. I would let him, like, plainly dome in a league where he did not. Now, again, that's not my decision. Neither of these guys should pitch in the big leagues again. But I do understand. I think you make a really good point, which is the distinction between these two guys is significant in how the document reads. I think the last thing to talk about, there are really two more. One is just like Andy Pages. I think we just need to bring that up. It is the comedic nugget in here. It is comic relief, I guess is the way to describe it.
He doesn't get named. He doesn't get named, but everyone figured it out pretty quickly.
He might as well be named. They are trying to throw balls. And when you learn that they're trying to throw balls, what is funny is that you don't actually have full control over that, right? Because a hitter can swing and a hitter can miss. And when you're Emmanuel Clase and you're one of the nastiest pitchers on the planet, you can accidentally get a guy to swing. And when you're facing someone like Andy Pages, who would swing at me throwing crumpled up ball of aluminum foil into the trash can in my kitchen, you are at risk of failing. And that is what happened. There is a highlight of Classe trying to throw a ball, of Andy Pye swinging and missing at it. And then there is, like, what is it, evidence in the text messages between Classe and the better of, like, sad face emojis, even though the Guardians won the game, right? That yeah, is
we
kind
were at that
of,
game.
We were at that game.
Yeah. Did you just realize that? Yeah, man. This is when you came to visit me earlier this season to see the Dodgers. That was the day game. It was the series finale.
How did I miss it? It was right there.
I know.
It was right there. Andy Pye.
That specific pitch was a way better pitch than a lot of the other ones. Most of the pitches that are described, and obviously by now, I imagine most people listening to this have seen all the clips. Especially the two Ortiz ones are like, I mean, they might as well be cricket
preposterous, you
know, bowls. I mean, we're spiking them way in front of the plate. But yeah, the Pajes thing is tough because coming off the worst postseason ever, literally by some measures, like lowest OPS in postseason history, minimum 50 plate appearances. And now this, it's like, oh, Andy Pajes is the worst hitter of all time. And then you go back and you look, I'm like, man, Andy Pajes had an awesome season.
Had a good year.
Had a really good year. 4 WAR. So anyway, but that is indisputably funny. And yes, there are some other details within the indictment that are kind of difficult not to laugh at once you balance the and honestly, it reminds me of when we did this with Ipe, right? You read the legal documents describing what Ipe was doing, you know, losing millions and millions on college soccer. Like, yeah, there's some funny kernels in there. And then the other parts of it is like, wow, this is just like the saddest thing of all time. Like, this is like a level of betrayal and you know, shame and addiction that bums me out. And then, but as you know, we're always trying to kind of balance a lot of things at once. And this case, as we kind of wrap this conversation, like, that's the thing. Like, we're still going to learn more about this. Obviously, now that we have this public unsealing of an indictment, that will provide reporters with enough other kernels to pursue. And this story is not over, but the picture that we learn here is significant in how it kind of describes Classe and what we're taking from it in terms of Ortiz. But like I said, everyone's going to have a slightly different feeling reading this indictment. And so, as always, we encourage people to email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Like, there's elements and angles that we are absolutely not touching here. Some of that is on purpose, some of that is not. We're doing our best. There's a lot more, way more fun stuff that we want to do on this episode of Baseball Barbercast, so we're going to cut this part off here. But it's obviously a huge bit of news that we've been waiting for, and we'll kind of see what happens next.
This is not our last one of these. We will get, there will be more in future years. Like, the I think the Eastern District of New York will re-enter the podcast forum at some point.
Yeah, in that the part, not so right. Who knows what court will be giving us these stories, but obviously in MLB's proactive response, they're going to try and, you know, curb some of this stuff and get ahead of it. But there's still, as you mentioned, this is still a runaway train in a lot of respects, and we're still going to be, gambling's not about to become less relevant anytime soon. So we're going to have to keep kind of fending these scandals off to some degree, and that is troubling.
I don't mind one legal document a year. I mean, like, obviously crime is bad, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I want to be a lawyer? Absolutely not. But, you know, every once in a blue moon, sitting down with a coffee and a 23-page legal document kind of brings you back to junior year of college in the library, you know, it was nice. At least personally, it was nice. All right, let's take a break.
It makes me think, I will just say, but it does make me think, you mentioned that, where it's like, if you have a big bit of reading to do, like, again, think about college and you get the big PDF and it's like, you know what? I'm going to print this bad boy out. I think I'm going to be more likely to read this. Now, in this case, I did not print this out because I didn't have easy access to a printer, but I might have. Like, if I was still in college, I think I would have used the printer to print out the indictment and really kind of highlight it. You know, swipe the student IDs. Like, yeah, I'm going to use some of my printing money to make sure that I could read that, you know, he was, it's for a horse.
It's for a horse.
We're going to we're not, by the way, the It's for a Horse.
Yeah.
Again, shouldn't be laughing at this because it's sad, but it's not just the tell him it's for a horse. It's the Ortiz saying, okay, perfect. I'm like, oh, God.
Perfect. Oh.
Oh, perfect. Got it. Nailed it. Perfect. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we return, it's award season, folks. This is going to be a lot more fun to talk about. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is awards season. We just had some elections in this country that I did not get to vote in because I'm a DC resident. I did vote in the New York mayoral primary. If you're my friend, you can ask me who I voted for. You could probably guess. But Jordan, you got to vote. You got to vote recently. Yeah. You got to vote for American League Rookie of the Year. It is the third year, the third time that you, as a member of the BBWA, the Baseball Writers Association of America, BBWA, you got to vote. You got to vote on postseason awards. I am also a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. However, I am still, for the rest of the year, a member of the New York chapter. And the way it works, right, is it's broken up into chapters. Each chapter gets two votes, effectively, for each award. Two people get a vote. Those votes are kind of doled out to various people in the chapter. When you're in the New York chapter, it is far and away the largest chapter by like a factor of three. And so I have never received one of the votes for that. That's fine. I am young and dumb. Jordan, however, as a member of both the Cleveland and Cincinnati chapters, there are way fewer people in those chapters. And so you have gotten to vote all 3 years. Now that I am in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Baltimore chapter is what they're combined into one. I presumably, hopefully, will get a vote next year. I will
definitely more likely
friend of the program,
I like your chances,
Chelsea Janes, who is the president of our chapter, into giving me one. Jordan Schusterman.
All right.
That is a lot of preamble. You voted for the American League Rookie of the Year, and you, like 29 other beautiful souls, put Nick Kurtz first. Nick Kurtz is your American League Rookie of the Year. Jordan, why'd you do that?
He was really good. He was.
Oh!
It is great that, like, he comes up. He's good. Remember, he plays like 30 minor league games, and. You know, and I wrote about my ballot. Our colleague Russ Dorsey also had an AL Rookie of the Year ballot, and we did a little behind the scenes look. Which, yeah, it wasn't just like we both voted for Nick Kurtz. The end. Beyond that, I think there was some interesting discussions to be had, and that's why we decided to write about it. But the Kurtz thing, as I kind of alluded to in what I wrote about, you know, we justifiably marveled over Trey Savage, who hilariously will be eligible next year, but. Trey Savage and what he did in the postseason, and this doesn't take anything away from him, but it's just like, how is this guy doing this? He was in the low A, and then he was just drafted last year. Nick Kurtz went from drafted last year to a top 10 hitter in the league like that. And as good of a season as his teammate Jacob Wilson had and Roman Anthony when he was healthy, this was an unbelievable debut, historic by many respects. The slugging numbers that Nick Kurtz produced, and that is not just in his minor league park in Sacramento. Like, wherever he went, this dude was hitting the ball hard and far and often. And wow, I mean, you can, whether it's slugging, whether it's home run, whether it's ISO, like, this was a historic rookie season. It really was. And sure, the sample wasn't a full season, but I am so impressed with what he was able to do, and this was certainly an easy pick at the top of the ballot.
If you sort by OPS on the day that Nick Kurtz debuted to the rest of the season, number one, Aaron Judge. Number two, Shohei Ohtani. Number three, Nick Kurtz. Like, that's the,
there you go.
That's it.
that's an amazing sentence. Yes. This was not good for a rookie. This is one of the best hitters in the league. And as I tweeted about yesterday, incredibly, his pal, Jacob Wilson, who could not be more different, finishes second with another impressive season in a completely different way, which is never striking out, because Nick Kurtz did strike out a whole bunch. But Jacob Wilson, who finished second in batting average in the league, played like 120 games at shortstop and hit for way more power than I thought he honestly ever would. 13 homers for Jacob Wilson is like, I would have, if you said before the year, like, what's Jacob Wilson's career high in home runs going to be in a single season, I would have said like 11. And the fact that he, sure, yeah, he still has the lowest hard hit rate and bat speed, whatever. He is finding ways, but you can comp him to Luis Arraez, sure, and there's some truth to that. He has found ways to actualize his very modest raw power into slugging production in a very impressive way. And I ended up voting Wilson over Anthony second, just essentially just based on the positional value of him playing way more shortstop than Anthony played. He didn't play any center field, but even corner outfield. Would I take Roman Anthony over Jacob Wilson long term? Yes, absolutely. But I was a Jacob Wilson skeptic coming into the year and out of the draft, and he has won me over to a degree as a unique, special hitter. Is he going to be able? The BABIP won't always be kind to him every season, and maybe he will fluctuate a little bit. Maybe he's a second baseman long term, but I love that Jacob Wilson exists and that he's found a way to be successful already.
I also think that in this day and age, the thing that you can most improve upon is bat speed, probably, as a hitter.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there are ways to get better at that. And you could see a world in which Jacob, we have evidence, like Jacob Wilson, a couple winters of just swinging really heavy bats and doing high speed training, like that could improve and he could add some juice a little bit. You had Roman Anthony third on your ballot. He only played 71 Major League Baseball games this year. He was freaking awesome in those 71 baseball games. What made you comfortable enough with him being that good in a small sample to jump him over his teammate? Who basically caught all year for a team that made the playoffs?
Yeah, so I ended up voting, as you're referencing, Carlos Narvaez fourth. And Narvaez ends up finishing sixth behind Noah Cameron, who I had fifth, and Colson Montgomery. And I want to bring Colson Montgomery into this conversation as well, because what Colson Montgomery did for the White Sox in the exact same number of games as Roman Anthony was really impressive. He hit, I think, 14 more home runs? Like, he had a ridiculous power surge and was playing a good shortstop. And so I did have to think about, and by the way, it's important to note that this is the first year that you were able to vote for five players in Rookie of the Year, expanded from three. It had been three for the previous however many years, and now it's five. And so these last two spots got interesting, and you could see for the number of different players that got votes in those four and five spots. For me, Anthony was significant enough compared to Montgomery, because as I also argued as it related to Narvaez, the Red Sox played their best baseball when Roman Anthony was batting leadoff, and indisputably he was driving that offense in a real way once Devers was gone that you can't dispute. And for Roman Anthony also, not that again we just sort by ex-woba, but like, it was real, man. I mean, everything under the hood said yes, he is already one of the best hitters in the sport, OBP of nearly 400, and I did think that he impressed on me enough for him to be third, but I really wanted to make sure Narvaez was on there. The Red Sox were so much better when he was behind the plate. And I was so impressed with him. And yes, his offense really tailed off in the second half, but he was elite at essentially everything defensively. And I love catchers. And I didn't have the opportunity to vote for Cal Raleigh this year, so I wanted to throw a catcher a vote of support. And I think Carlos Narvaez absolutely deserved it. And and then Noah Cameron had an ERA under three in 130 innings, which is hard to do as a rookie pitcher.
I think I probably would have had Narvaez third because you like catchers. I think I praise them. I probably hold them up in too high a regard. The Colson Montgomery and Roman Anthony is a really interesting conversation. I think there's a clear top six here.
Yes.
I think there's a clear top two, and that's Kurtz, Wilson. And then I think that next four you could put in really any other order, which is the three you voted for and Colson Montgomery. I think that there are – people get so cute on the bottom of their Rookie of the Year ballots. Like, voting for Luke Kuechel over Colson Montgomery, You can get even cuter at the end now that this five. Like, Kiesel played like half the games, was worse, played a less important position. There are just some like Jason Dominguez getting a fifth place vote.
Yeah.
Just bizarre.
There's some strange ones.
You love this stuff.
I love it. And again, this is relevant to our third segment, which we'll get to in terms of predicting the MVP ballots. But I don't know. In this case, these lower place votes didn't impact the results. The top three was interesting. And we would have even less to talk about. If you could only vote for three, we probably would have only been talking about these six. But maybe not. We would have maybe only been talking about really three or four. And so for that, I'm grateful.
My favorite vote in a positive way. Shouts out David Singh at Sportsnet, who I met during the playoffs. Chandler Simpson at five. Yeah. Giving Chandler Simpson a fifth place vote, I think, is like a great use of a fifth place vote in that it's like it says something and it's not like egregious.
Well, and it's clear. It's interesting when you see what, because you can kind of sometimes you look at a ballot and you're like, how did you get here? And it's clear in David's ballot that he was valuing which rookies played the most. He voted for Jack Leiter and Will Warren. And I get that. Those guys made 27, 28 starts. Chandler Simpson played over 100 games, right? So you can say, okay, how does Chandler Simpson vote for him over Anthony or Montgomery? It's like, well, he played more of the season. Okay, that's fine.
Chandler Simpson finished tied for second in stolen bases in Major League Baseball. Totally fine with me. Yeah. All right, let's move over to the National League, where things were a lot cloudier. Particularly at the top, your 2025 Jackie Robinson NL Rookie of the Year is Drake Baldwin, catcher for the Atlanta Braves. Baldwin received 21 of the 30 first place votes. The 9 other first place votes went to Cade Horton, a starting pitcher for the Chicago Cubs. He finishes in second. Caleb Durbin, former podcast guest and fellow Washington University and St. Louis Bear. What a freaking world. Finishes third in the voting, getting 2 second place votes and 13 third place votes. This was a fun one. Jordan, let's actually do it this way. What would your ballot have been in the NL Rookie of the Year?
I'm not 100% certain what I would have had 3 through 5. I think I would have ended up with so the order was Baldwin, Horton in terms of final points was Baldwin, Horton, Durbin, Isaac Collins, Dalen Lyle, who I'm a huge fan of. Would he have ended up on there for me? I don't know. A couple Marlins, but those were smaller sample sizes. Yeah, I actually think it probably would have been about what we saw, how it finished. Easier for me to say now. I think Durbin, man, what a freaking story. We had him on basically exactly a year ago after the Yankees had added him to the 40-man roster, and we were like, well, this guy's going to be important for the Yankees. Well, they could have used him. I know Devin Williams had his ups and downs, but Caleb Durbin was a lot better than what they were rolling out at third base until they traded for Ryan McMahon and after they traded for Ryan McMahon. That said, I definitely would have voted for Drake Baldwin at the top. I guess all I'll say about him is like, I love that this was a great case of, if you looked at what Drake Baldwin did last season, really all throughout the minors, but if you looked at what he did in AAA last year and you looked at the underlying stuff and you said, this is about as safe of a hitter as you could possibly bank on. And that's even as a catcher. Everything he was doing process-wise, hitting the ball hard, swing decisions, lifting the ball in the air, it was like, this is going to work. And it just did immediately. It was such a comforting, just like, oh, yes, baseball makes sense. Sometimes you can look at the certain collection of numbers and say, this guy is going to hit. And that's what he did. Now he's the Rookie of the Year. And that's awesome. That's a hell of a freaking find for Atlanta. For this guy to be a team that already had, of course, a good catcher in Sean Murphy, to get this guy in the third round and have him be Rookie of the Year 3 years later was incredible. So I'm a huge Drake Baldwin fan. I was not surprised that he won. I think Cade Horton, it was kind of a strange season for him. Some injuries along the way. Was not striking out a lot of guys, really at all.
No.
But the ERA was really low. Was doing it on a playoff team. So I understand voting for him, but I would have voted for Baldwin pretty comfortably.
I mean, the argument for Cade Horton, I believe this is true. In the wild card era, if you're doing like rookie ERA single season, it's like, I think it's DeGrom, Skeens, Jose Fernandez, and Cade Horton.
Yeah, I don't know if it by the end it was that, because he definitely had a stretch like in the second half where it was like almost under two. And if you were just doing, if you did the right splits, 2.67 is very low. I don't know if that's historically low. But yeah, I mean, you know, 118 innings. So, you know, we're not talking.
Fourth lowest ERA in the wildcard era by a rookie with at least 20 starts, behind only Hideo Nomo, Paul Skeens, and Jose Fernandez. I mean, like, that's, okay, yeah. That like, is, if you voted for Kate Horton,
that's compelling.
That's a totally legitimate argument, right? Like, I have absolutely no issue with that. I think the Brewers guys all kind of stole votes from each other.
Yeah, it was tough.
A little bit, right? Like, parsing Durbin and Collins and Patrick and even Mizorowski, who got a fourth place vote. Like, they were all really important, and I think it's fine how it ended up. I actually do think I would have just voted the way that it ended. I might have had Dylan Lyle over Isaac Collins.
Awesome,
I think
dude.
Dylan Lyle's really good.
Again, not a good defender in the outfield, but he was raking for the last, you know, two months, and he's impressive.
My two favorite votes on this are Jack Dreyer for the Dodgers, who got a third place vote and 1 5th place vote. Jack Dreyer, who kind of fell down the trust tree pecking order as the playoffs went along. I mean, in the regular season, 76 innings with a 2.95 for a Dodgers team that during the regular season just needed human beings to throw baseballs towards home plate. And then my other favorite vote is Nolan McClain. I think that Nolan McClain gets 2 5th place votes. If you're going on bulk, it is very silly. He only made 8 starts. Boy, were they 8 good starts. And boy, did the Mets need those 8 starts. And it still didn't matter. But like, think about it this way, right? Like, Nolan McClain.
It's like, whew. If they didn't have Nolan McClain, they wouldn't have even come close to making the playoffs as opposed to getting eliminated in the final week. All right. Good stuff.
So there you go.
But no, he was awesome. I mean, all if we're just talking about impact and who you would take moving forward. Yeah, Nolan McClain, obviously pretty high on the list. All right.
The most egregious, outrageous vote on here. I think we got to speak truth to power. The Heriberto Hernandez vote is hilarious to me. He was good. If you're listening to this,
to me,
you're like, what
it's
team
like,
is he on? He's on the Marlins. No. He had a 784 OPS in 294 plate appearances. Voting for Heriberto Hernandez over, like, any of these other hitters even is just very funny. Very funny to me.
Yes. To me, it's
over Dalen Lyle. Over Dalen Lyle is like is outrageous.
To me, it's if you're in the Miami chapter and you want to vote for Heriberto, that's fine. But you probably can't also vote for Augustine Ramirez, which is what happened.
And this is the thing. I do want to actually briefly touch on this dynamic that's in voting. Is that like it you're put in a tough spot in a way when you vote, right? Because if you vote for the player on the team you cover, people call you a homer. And if you don't vote for the guy on the team you cover, that guy and his teammates will be mad at you the following year when you have to do your job, right? And so like that creates an issue.
Again, I don't think the average, like, that's not how this should be thought about. I understand what you're saying. Obviously, there's a human nature to that.
But subconsciously for people.
And there's a range of how much that matters, how much should matter, how much players care, how much, like, it's totally, you know, who knows. But I don't know. Like, you'll get to vote and
think about it this way.
Seriously.
Think about it this way.
Seriously, we're all doing our best. Yeah.
If you're in the Seattle market, I don't know who has those AL MVP votes. If you're in the Seattle market and you vote Judge over Raleigh and Judge wins and you show up at spring training, like, let's just say friend of the show, Ryan Divish does that, right? He doesn't really need the cachet necessarily, but like that for a certain type of reporter, like that is a thing. Like that is a relevant data point that influences
your
voting.
Just have to look at,
I don't know if there's any way to fix
it,
that.
Just look at the votes. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, there are some complicated dynamics involved in this stuff that is less fun to talk about, but either way, we will choose to do our best when we have the privilege to do so, to vote, and also make some jokes because it's baseball awards. It's not that serious. All right. We are going to take a break. We are going to continue our conversation about baseball awards, previewing the MVP race for one final time. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecast.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Minster and Schusterman will fly through the rest of these awards tonight. We'll get Manager of the Year. It will be Pat Murphy in the National League. And it will be, I think, either Stephen Vogt or Dan Wilson in the American League. I don't think John Schneider will win. People will lose their minds because this is voted on before the playoffs. That is silly because the playoffs are when the manager really matters. That is a sentence I just spoke. The Cy Youngs will be Paul Skenes and Tarek Skubal. The NL MVP will be Shohei Ohtani. Sorry for the spoilers. And then the AL MVP will be a coin flip between Aaron Judge and Cal Raleigh. We have talked about this ad nauseum. For me, it is this simple. Aaron Judge is the best hitter on the planet. Cal Raleigh is worse than Aaron Judge at hitting. I think everyone agrees that that is true. I think Cal Raleigh probably agrees that that is true. Aaron Judge is a better hitter with better offensive numbers overall than Cal Raleigh. The question then becomes, how important is being a catcher? You can value that at X. You can value that at Y. If that value pushes Raleigh over Judge for you, you and I can be friends. If it doesn't, you and I can be friends. And that's it. I wish it was more complicated. You can do the how many homers would Judge have hit in Safeco and Raleigh, how many would he have hit in Yankee Stadium, whatever. I think that's all just noise to me. And it really just comes down to how unique is and impressive is a season like this from a catcher. And if you think it's very impressive enough to vault him over Judge, great. And if you don't, great.
Yep. You have maintained a stronger belief that Cal has a chance to win than I have throughout this process. I think we will stay on that side for now. I think Cal will certainly get a good number of votes. I think Judge will still get more. Maybe we end with a tie. That would be amazing. It's, again, it's 30 voters. We know these two are going to get all the first and second place votes. We've had some really, really, really close races before, but not the closest in the voting totals is 2017 National League, where Giancarlo Stanton beat Joey Votto by 2 points. But those two guys did not get all of the first place votes. And so that was a more spread out field. This one, you know, we know who we're talking about here. And I'm fascinated. That mean I'm going to be shocked if Cal Raleigh wins? No, because he's a catcher that hit 60 home runs. I don't know. I think Judge still has reached a level of like, oh my God, we have not seen this since Barry Bonds. And I think he will be acknowledged as such. But we will see. I'm excited to find out, obviously. And whether Cal wins or not, I'm still grateful to have witnessed his season from beginning to end, all the way until his home run in Game 7 of the ALCS, which was the last run the Mariners scored this season.
Last run the Mariners ever scored. Before we do our MVP guessing game, I would just very briefly like to shout out Jose Ramirez, who is going to finish third. He is the third finalist. Depending on how many votes he gets, he is going to vault up to like third or second on the all-time MVP share leaderboard among players without an MVP. Now, what that means is basically your overall career MVP vote value just like accumulated over time. He is currently fifth on that list. So statistically, you could say the best player ever without an MVP, right? Or like the most, I guess is just one way to frame it, behind Al Simmons, Bill Terry, Eddie Murray, Mike Piazza. He could be, depending on how it shakes out, like first on this list by the end of the week, which would be fascinating. What a player, what a career. I hope he gets one. He probably won't. I love Jose Ramirez so much.
Yeah.
Let's do our dumb
game. And it wasn't even a certainty. Like, I think it was going to be between him and Bobby Witt. who, as our friend Vinny Pasquantino pointed out on Twitter, he was like, LOL, Bob won Silver Slugger and Gold Glove in a down year. I'm like, yep, pretty much. But I, too, love Jose Ramirez, and I'm excited to see him. And by the way, Bobby Witt will also be interesting because he could very rapidly he's much more likely to win one at some point. He just has to wait for Aaron Judge to stop being so awesome, and then he will have his time to shine. All right, so what we're going to do is a game we did last year, and I had so much fun with it that I wanted to bring it back. So the way that this is going to work is that, okay, Judge, Raleigh, cool, whatever, we know that. Shohei Ohtani, awesome, we're aware of that. MVP voters have 10 spots on the ballot, which means they have the opportunity to throw MVP votes to 10 different players. What that means is you get a whole bunch of different guys getting votes, especially once you get past the top four or five. Yes, usually there's 3 to 5 to 6 guys that will appear on all 30 ballots in each league, but after that, boy, does it get interesting. And last year, I kind of went back and reviewed how many players on average appear on the ballot in each league and found that the answer is around 20 to 25. Each year, a different 20 to 25 different players in each league receive at least one MVP vote. That is usually between 15 to 20 hitters, usually between 3 to 5 starting pitchers, and usually about one reliever, but not always. There's not always a reliever that gets a vote. So with all that in mind, last year we played a game where before the MVP award gets announced, we try and guess who is going to receive votes. That is what we are going to do here today at the end of the show. Jake is going to present his guesses as to who will receive votes in the American League first. I will then share which of those I agree with. And then we will reverse and I will go in the NL and Jake will do the same. So, Jake, take it away. We're not going to spend too much time on each player. But who do you believe will be receiving, again, just one? All you did, if it's 1/10th place vote, that counts as a victory here. Who will be getting votes in the American League?
So I will do the AL. As I go, you let me know after each player if they're on your list. I have my top 10 in order of how I would vote, just for fun.
Okay, I didn't do that for the NL, but sure. Yep.
I have mine for the NL as well, but I will begin. Cal Raleigh. Aaron Judge, Jose Ramirez, Bobby Witt Jr., Tarek Skubal, Garrett Crochet, George Springer, Julio Rodriguez, Junior Caminero, and Vlad Guerrero Jr. I assume all 10 of those guys are on your list.
Yes. I have all of those gentlemen as locks to receive a vote. So
I will say, in fact, for me, it was a pretty clear top 10. The next three players I'm calling shortstops. This is Jeremy Pena. This is Gunnar Henderson. Yep. And this is Bo Bichette. All three of whom I think will get votes.
Okay. So Bo, I have as a lock. Gunnar, I cannot fully commit to. I think it's totally plausible. He was essentially like a diet version of Bobby Witt, where it was like he was way worse than last year and still amazing. But this time it was for a Orioles team that stunk. So I will, for simplicity's sake, agree with you and go with Gunnar Henderson as well.
I think somebody is going to sort by war and be like, oh, a shortstop played 154 games.
A lot of people are going to sort by war.
And put up 4.8 war. So that's why he's on my list. Okay. The next group I call Byron Buxton.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think lock for me as well. Is he a lock for
14.
You?
Yes. The next group I call other Yankees. This is Cody Bellinger and this is Jazz Chisholm Jr.
Cody Bellinger, I do believe, is a near certainty to receive votes. Jazz, having gone 30-30, I am not gonna say Jazz. I'll go ahead and split up. Not I'm saying he doesn't deserve it, but I think Bellinger I feel very good about. I will differ on you for Jazz.
Great. My next group is called that's a lot of homers. That is Nick Kurtz.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is Riley Green of the Detroit Tigers.
Okay.
Now, Riley Green was worse than you think. A lot of strikeouts tailed off as the season went along, but I just think that a Detroit Tiger hitter is going to get a vote, and I think that Riley Green hit enough home runs for somebody to put him down to the ballot.
I think I agree with you. The thing that gives me pause is that we both picked Riley Green last year, and he did not get any votes. Now, the Tigers were, I guess, not really better than they were last year, or I guess they were slightly. It was very weird. I don't even know how to really say that because sure. It was so bad in the second half and so good in the first half. So, but I think you're... I think Riley Green's more likely than Jazz. I'll say that.
Disagree.
So I will go with you. I will say Riley Green, yes, just because I don't feel good about it. But okay, fine. I'll agree with you on Riley Green.
My next pick is Aroldis Chapman.
He's on my list. If I am going to put a reliever, it's probably him. But I'm gonna not pick him. He was on here, but I'm not picking him.
I wanted one reliever, like between both leagues, and he was the reliever I picked. I have three more names. So I'm currently 19. This will be 20, 21, and 22. Two guys who in a group I call didn't play a lot, but whoa.
Yep.
Corey Seager
yep.
and Jonathan Aranda.
Yes. So Seager is a tough one. Seager also had this issue last year where he was amazing. Obviously was hurt because he's Corey Seager. Did get, I think, one like 10th place vote. This year he played even less, but was he was awesome for sure. But man, it's like 100 games. And I think Aranda too. I know you sort by WRC plus. He's right there. I'm gonna say no on either of them. I'm gonna say no on both of those.
Okay. I think the problem with Aranda is that he doesn't show up on like leaderboards. If you don't,
well, no, put the minimum qualified, down. Right? You have to lower it. You have to lower the minimum. Same thing for Seager.
Yeah, but the difference is people know Corey Seager's hurt and playing 100 games every year or whatever. Yes. Jonathan Aranda, I think, just as a Ray behind Caminero, I think he's got a chance. And then the last one is Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown, I have on here because three starting pitchers usually get votes.
Yep.
And so he's the third one. He's on my list. So that is my 22. Who do you have that I do not have?
Right. So you said, I'm sorry if I missed you. You have Michael Garcia and Springer. You mentioned those guys.
I do not have Michael Garcia on here.
Do not have Michael Garcia. Interesting. Okay. I think Michael Garcia is a lock just because he's high enough on the war leaderboard. Like, I think Michael is more likely than Gunner, even. Yeah, I actually do.
Okay.
Okay, wow. Okay, you had Springer, right? You mentioned him earlier. The only other ones to mention, and I mentioned Springer, is again, the Blue Jays, too. Would Kirk get some votes?
Kirk.
That was one I considered.
Notable mentions.
And then other than that, a version of Seager would be Bregman.
Yep.
But that's, if we're going full Yankees, Ben Rice, and that's, I don't think that's happening. Smaller sample catchers, Shea Langeliers, Dylan Dingler, awesome seasons. Don't think that they are getting on there. And then if we're just doing like counting stats, like it's the 80s, you know, Vinny Pasquantino, Wyatt Langford, you know, hooray, hooray. But
Joe Adele.
Otherwise, I think, but otherwise, we're pretty much in sync here. And then Yandy Diaz, I think, is another one if you're just going by offensive production. But so, Michael. Wow. Okay. So you don't think you're out on Michael? That's okay. Interesting.
I don't know. I'm not out on Michael. I think people will be out. Like, I think.
It's six one.
You know what?
It's hard for me to imagine.
You might have convinced me.
It's hard for me to imagine the Kansas City chapter not voting for
Michael. Yeah. Okay. I'm adding Michael. Yeah. You've convinced me.
Okay.
When presented with new information, as humans, it is important to change our opinions. I am doing that, and I'm going to add Michael Garcia to my list, giving me 23 players. Jordan, National League, please.
National League. Here we go. I did not do mine in order, but I will do my locks off the top here. Okay. Ohtani. Heard of him? Good player.
Good.
Schwarber and Soto are our other finalists, so we don't have to discuss those. Although it is interesting that, like, war-wise, Schwarber was, 12th or 14th or something.
I would have had Soto second and Schwarber third.
Oh, my bad. That is interesting. But we're not going to spend time on that. Other locks for me include
Trey Turner.
Yep.
Geraldo Perdomo. Francisco Lindor.
Yep.
Corbin Carroll. Fernando Tatis Jr. Paul Skeens. Christopher Sanchez.
Indeed.
Okay. Those are 1,000,000,000% going to get votes. Okay, great. PCA is probably the player I am most interested in where he ends up. I'm going to put him on my lock, even though he had the 280 on base and was awful in the second half. I don't think he's going to finish particularly highly. Like, I don't think he's even going to finish in the top 10. I think he will get at least a couple votes. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, great. Let me get the rest of the pitchers out of the way, because I struggled between for my third pitcher, and I did not end up doing, I'm not saying Edwin Diaz would be my reliever candidate. I don't think he's going to get one. I think Chapman's more likely than Diaz, so I'm moving him to side. I struggled between Yamamoto and Logan Webb. I know Yamamoto is the third Cy Young finalist, but I also think Logan Webb with the innings and just like him being the rock of the Giants, I could see him ending up at the end. But ultimately, I am going to say Yamamoto. I am going to go with Yamamoto because I think that like he, again, it related to just like how important he was to the Dodgers, and that's even before he went, you know, God mode in the postseason. So great. Yamamoto, those are my three pitchers. Not complicating that. Okay. My next two, again, leaning into the war here, are Nico Hoerner and Bryce Turang. Turang, I feel better about than Hoerner, just because Hoerner, the sorting through the Cubs is difficult. More on that in a second. There's got to be a Brewer in some form. I think Turang, and he had a great offensive season and is still a good defender, and he's going to show up on there. And I just don't see a world where no Brewer gets a vote. Okay, Freddy Peralta enters this conversation to some degree. Is that what you were going to say about a Brewer?
No. So I have Turang and I do not have Hoerner.
Okay, got it. So now let's bring in another Cubs conversation. You have other Brewers. Actually, then do that now, because I do not. So what other Brewers would you like to mention?
And Frelick. I think Frelick is going as, like, if you're around the Brewers, Frelick is like the guy, sneaky. And I think that someone in the extended baseball universe will learn that information and will have seen him play a unreal series. Like, when Frelick is locked in and he's getting on base and he's a pest, like, he exemplified the Brewers this season more than really any other player. I would not vote for him, but I think that somebody will. And then Yelich is like, he's the Brewer, you know, like he's the Brewer.
Yeah.
So I have Yelich and Frelick on my list.
I thought stronger about Yelich than Frelick, just because I think if you're sitting down and you're not, and it's also possible that the Brewers, the Milwaukee voters vote for three Brewers or four Brewers because they were the best team in baseball, and that's whatever, fine. I just think Turang is, I don't know, but I hear you. And I agree that, right, Frelick does embody it in a lot of ways, and that's fine.
And you say the best team in baseball, and to be clear, that's why when you parse through the Cubs versus the Brewers, I think I have Hoerner off and I have the Brewers on.
Okay.
But go ahead and tell me about the
Cubs.
So
let's bring in another category, which is four first basemen with very similar cases, but team dependent, you can make an argument. That's Pete Alonso, that's Michael Bush, that's Matt Olson, that's Freddie Freeman. I am going to say that Alonso, Bush, and Olson all get votes. Alonso's the one I feel the strongest about. Olson, I feel very good about. I think playing 162 games
helps
him. And then Bush was just awesome. And again, like, does he... I've said him before Kyle Tucker. We haven't gotten to him yet. I don't know. I'm a sucker for Michael Bush. So, like, would you have Bush over Hoerner?
Yeah, I have Bush on my list and I don't have Hoerner.
Okay. All right. Understood. Okay, great. So we'll have that. And then Freddie's one where it's like, would I be surprised? No, but I think I'm going to leave him off. Do you have Freddie?
No.
No Freddie. Okay. Now, the last three for me. Sorry, I have four left.
Okay, I have four left as well, and I think they're going to be the same as your four. Go right ahead.
Okay. So part of the reason why I didn't pick Freddie is because I think Will Smith is more likely. Even with smaller amount of playing time, I think Will Smith was amazing And I think Will Smith will get some votes.
If I had a ballot, I would have Will Smith seventh on my ballot. I love catchers. He had an all-time good offensive season for a catcher.
Great. Another smaller sample, but I also think the residual of how he finished last year and just has the reputation. I think Ketel Marte, another Diamondback who was awesome when he played. I think Ketel Marte will still get a handful of votes.
Off my list.
Understood. My last two, and then we can throw out a couple other names. This is fully leaning into someone from the local chapter is going to vote for them. One of them is Kyle Stowers, if you lower the minimum, he's essentially a better, he's basically a Ronda, but an even more compelling case than a Ronda, in my opinion, if you lower the minimum.
Yeah. Right. I'm adding Stowers based upon the Heriberto Hernandez vote.
Okay. And then finally, if you listen to this game last year, you know that the grand reveal when I shared this with Jake, and we will do the same thing later this week, was that Ezekiel Tovar got two votes from both Colorado voters last year. And even though the Rockies lost 119 games this year, I'm going to call my shot and say that Hunter Goodman is going to get a 10th place vote once again.
Yeah.
For what is essentially the same season as Ezekiel Tovar, except as the catcher. And I am going to just lean all the way into that. And so that is the end of my list. I have other guys that we could talk about, but that's the end of my list.
This is such a good call that I'm not going to add it to my list.
Okay. Okay, that's fine.
So good. Couple other names.
Other guys. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple other guys on my list. So I have James Wood on my list.
Yeah, consider him.
I think his first half was so good. It's similar to PCA in a way.
Sure.
Just with the fall off. I think he gets on.
And on a way worse team, which hurts.
I think Ellie De La Cruz gets a vote. Just because he's Ellie De La Cruz. I know his season was whatever. He had 22 homers. He stole 37 bases as a shortstop. I think Ellie gets a vote. I think Kyle Tucker gets a vote.
Tucker is one, again, it's just like, are all of these Cubs going to get votes? Maybe, probably.
Okay.
That's fine.
Yep. And then the last one I have is Gino Suarez.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Yeah.
Eugenio Suarez, it's a little complicated, right? Because he gets traded to the American League at the deadline. And so it's a lesser body of work. But that's a lot of homers. And if he spends the whole season in the NL and doesn't get traded, I think he's a lock, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, because he homers. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And so I think that then becomes a conversation, right? Did he do enough in the National League? He doesn't show up on either the AL or the NL leaderboard, obviously. But he has 49 home runs. The other ones I had on the bottom of my list, just to shout out some names, Willy Adames, Bryce Harper, who is just boring and totally fine. And then the one I really wanted to do is Mookie, who was so bad offensively. But moving to shortstop and winning a gold glove maybe there is or did he win the gold glove there? I guess that already happened.
I think he was a finalist.
Whatever. He was awesome. That is another one. So those are our lists. We'll check back in on Friday and let you know how we did. We will reveal to one another. Maybe I'll reveal NL to you. You can reveal AL to me. And we'll have a good time. Thank you all for listening. That is our show. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas and Andrew Hartz for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. The offseason rolls on. On Friday, we will review the rest of the awards, maybe talk a little manager stuff, good, bad, ugly, of course. And then if you're listening and you live in the Dominican Republic, should let you know, Jake and Jordan headed down there to watch some winter ball early December. If that note pertains to you, email us. Let us know where to eat. That's all. Have a good day.